Now, first I want to voice my opinion in regard to the proponents of this legislation's use, and I want to underline that, of Mrs. Maureen Lohr and her son Jason's heartbreaking plight to make their point. I feel sorry for Mrs. Lohr. But I want to point out that in Afghanistan, little kids are getting their arms blown off every day and legs. And their mothers are having to live with it, and we're sorry, but that's the way the world is. Everywhere they go, they haul this woman out, and they push her in front of the camera as their star witness. This is an obscenity, and the people who are doing this are obscene.
You've spoken for 5 minutes now, and...
Other people got to speak longer. I'd just like to make a couple more points, and
I
understand.
I'll give you one more minute.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now, are we going to be able to watch this little boy's starvation on camera as well? I really doubt it. Can't they find any other examples? Are we going to use this one child's case to change the whole entire law in the state of Oregon that can affect thousands of people, men, women, children, grandmothers, and babies? Does that make sense? Secondly, I object to the use of the term public meeting for the 5 unpublicized meetings that were held last year. Ask anyone on the street in Portland what the term directive means, and you'll be met with a blank stare. These were token meetings, in my opinion, held to make this act of deceit, which is what this bill is, seem respectable and above board. And there's nothing has been said about it in the Oregonian, except for some articles that we initiated.
Your time is up. Your time is up. There are 21 other people who probably feel just like you do, or maybe close to
you. I know,
but
you have, honestly, Mr. Fry, you have let people speak for, you know, like a half an hour.
I also want
to indicate that as an indication of exactly what I'm saying.
If I let 22 people speak for half an hour each, we wouldn't be here all night.
Right, I understand that, but it's always the people who oppose these things thrown out, so.
Everybody on both sides, you've got a maximum of 5 minutes. Yeah. So the next one is... Mr. Taylor, Reverend Mr. Taylor, please.
Chairman Fry and members of the committee, my concern for this legislation comes out of my ministry with families who have to deal with the final illness of their loved ones, with personal experience with family members, and my wife's experience as a registered charge nurse in a Portland care center. While this legislation may not be perfect, it goes a long way towards the state's responding to the need for death with dignity in our society. We today seek good deaths, natural deaths, explainable deaths in the same way that mankind has throughout history. But we do so in a new way because medical technology has given us the power to hold off death in many cases with that technology. And this legislation is designed and comes about because of the need in our society to re-examine the question, when does death occur? More and more we die in centers where advanced technology is capable of prolonging life, and thus the dying process are available and often used. As a result, many persons now die in institutions under intensive care at a much older age, surrounded by an impressive battery of devices and machines in a very impersonal way. And under these circumstances, dying takes much longer and costs far more. Our technology may be capable of rescuing an individual from death, but may not be able to save the person from existence in a vegetative state with high social costs. Therefore, many people today fear that they will lose control over their lives when they approach death, and that things will be done to them that they could not want, and that they will not be given a choice to accept or refuse contemplated therapies. And this has given rise previously to the living will and now to this current legislation. The primary factors in these two bills are an attempt to respond to decisions about life or death based on the individual's wishes, needs, within the context of the community. as a minister of a church based upon a Reformed heritage, the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, which in 1983 adopted a policy statement and recommendations that deal with this issue, in which I have delineated in my written report to you, and in effort of time will not verbalize. I urge you to send this bill, to these bills, to the full Senate with a recommendation for passage at the earliest possible date. For in them is the freedom that we look for as we approach this issue. Senate Bills 20 and 21 provide room for all citizens to live and die with dignity that has been accorded each individual throughout all history, the right to a death that is not prolonged and degrading to one's person. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for being here. Next is C.W. Norris, and then after that witness, I'll call Catherine Parvin, then I'll call Bill Ullhorn. Okay.
Senator Frye, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Charles W. Norris, a retired obstetrician-gynecologist, and I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bills 20 and 21. We've heard pertinent comment today and a myriad of it as to how hard cases make bad law. Of course, some of these cases are terribly wrenching in their nature, and there are provisions in the law to take care of those things at this time, it would seem, but be that as it may. Senate Bill 20 would legalize assisted suicide in the state of Oregon. In view of many others testifying to their concerns, I would like to limit my remarks to commenting on sections 9 and 10 of Senate Bill 20. Traditionally, the physician's duty has always been to respect and preserve life. This duty rested upon a foundation of trust in the physician-patient relationship. Section 9 of Senate Bill 20 reads, quote, "A physician or licensed health professional or health care facility acting under the instructions of the attending physician or any other person who, in good faith, acts in substantial compliance with this act shall not be guilty of any criminal offense nor subject to any civil liability nor be in law violation of any professional oath, affirmation, or standard of care." In view of this section, it is not difficult to see that Senate Bill 20 could betray and destroy the sense of trust which a person places in his or her physician. Section 9 can betray this trust by requiring of a physician a test not in negligence, but only in good faith. A good faith test removes from the physician and absolves him of all accountability for his actions during the death and dying experience of his patient. Malice flows from an act lacking in good faith. Of grave concern to me is that proof of intentional malice would then be the only way a physician could ever be held accountable under this section. This is the specific section of the bill which would permit the physician to assist in the suicide of another, even to commit reckless homicide or second-degree murder without being held legally responsible for his actions, a carte blanche, if you will. In this age of modern medical technology, the burden of making these decisions indeed weighs heavily on physicians, but releasing the physician from their accountability in these matters by requiring of them a test only in good faith as opposed to a test in negligence is in distinct opposition to the best interests of the people of the state of Oregon and of society itself. We cannot legislate trust, nor compassion for that matter. All we can do is legalize killing. Section 10 of Senate Bill 20 reads, "Nothing in this act is intended to condone, authorize, or approve mercy killing, or to permit any affirmative or deliberate act or omission to end life other than to allow the natural process of dying as permitted in this act. Since there is no objective difference between taking a life by omission and taking it by commission, that is to say, between intentionally starving a person and stabbing him to death, the ruling of Section 10 at best is meaningless and at worst a mockery. Where do we draw the line? Once we let the euthanasia genie out of the bottle by the omission of nutrition and fluids for those in irreversible coma or a persistent vegetative state, who would be next? The person with Alzheimer's disease or any chronic mental patient with Alzheimer's superimposed? The severely and irreversibly demented patient? The person with incapacitating physical handicaps? The pleasantly senile? This was precisely the experience of the Nazi euthanasia experiment of 50 years ago. It wasn't the Nazis who implemented that program, it was the German doctors. Senate Bill 20 and 21 would be a quantum leap into the dark from what is and what has been considered acceptable, and represents a terrifying departure from current public policy. Senate Bill 21 aggravates the threat by allowing untrained third parties to make medical judgments with all the hazards that this implies. So in summary, I respectfully request that you members of the Senate Judiciary Committee table Senate Bills 20 and 21 and let them both die, so to speak, in committee, consistent with the dire consequences they portend for society. Besides, senators, it's not nice to send someone home without their dinner.
That's right. I appreciate your...
Senator, may I take one more?
Yes.
You know, what is of terrible concern to me here, and what I haven't heard here, is a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary means of preserving life. And I know my time is up, unless that distinction is drawn and it is demonstrated...
By the way, for our records, now, where do you practice medicine?
I'm retired.
Oh, sorry. All right.
I did practice in Portland, and before that I practiced here in Salem.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes. All right, now we have Mr. Elhorn or Uhorn, or how do you pronounce that? Well, come on up anyway. I'm sorry, you know, have I got a spell right? Uhlhorn?
Yeah.
Come on up, sir.
My name's Bill Uhlhorn. I'm executive director of a corporation that serves the homeless, the abused, and the mentally ill, but I'm here to speak as a parent whose son died less than a year and a half ago. On July 4th, 1985, our 23-year-old son, living in Hawaii, dove into a tidal pool and broke his neck. 3 weeks later, he was flown to a hospital in San Francisco where he had health insurance. Paralyzed from the neck down and on a respirator, on August 23rd, he made a conscious decision to die. And then he returned to our home on an October 9th and died on November 8th, 1985. There were three parts to his life in terms of those 3 months. The one is when he broke his neck, he would not have lived except that there was an ambulance practically right there, and they put him on life support systems, and when he was brought to the hospital, was on a respirator and was given food and nutrition intravenously. It was appropriate to keep him alive. He was then flown after 3 weeks back to San Francisco where we went down to spend time with him. And at that time, he was choosing to live. He had no sense, really, of what the paralysis was. All that he would have was movement from here up on a respirator for life. He needed time to make decisions. What I want to share with you was just a little bit of a statement that he wrote, and you have some of this in front of you. In discussions that my family and I have had with nurses, therapists, doctors, counselors, and handicapped individuals, I have done my best to collect information about what the future holds. Following are my understanding and thoughts in each area. Medical prognosis, I'm on a respirator, will be so for the rest of my life. As such, I will not be able to talk without the assistance of another individual. There's no way to predict how long I will live, but it's not uncommon for people with my injuries to die within 2 years. Physical occupational therapy prognosis. I might be able to use my head to operate switches allowing me movement in a wheelchair or use of computer. And he goes on to talk about that. Dying and death. I am not afraid of death and would in fact welcome death. I am afraid of dying in a painful way and would like to have my family present when I die. I believe that death is not an end but a passage into another life, and I'm ready to make this passage. What would I choose to live for? I've asked myself that numerous times. The Ed I once knew is no longer me. I realize it could change. Goes on to say, I know I am loved, and I have learned how much I am loved through this process. I know my wife loves me, and my mother and father love me, but I do not have to continue in this life for love to continue. I've seen my 2-year-old son, and I have confidence that he will grow up to be a fine man. I have lived life, but not always the best and the fullest, but right now I feel I can bring closure to my life. Continues then, my desire, with all these things in mind, my desire would be to unhook the present life support system or be given a shot that would allow me to die. I understand this is not possible because the law considers such action suicide. Since this course of action is not possible, I am requesting the following. I do not want my life prolonged, and I do not want any additional life-sustaining treatment to be provided. If any of the present life-sustaining treatment or devices are removed, I do not want them reintroduced. I do not want any heroic measures taken. I realize the process of dying can involve pain. I would request that you do what is necessary to relieve my pain, but not do it if it is prolonging my life. I choose to die. The issues that you have in front of you then were one that he needed to be kept alive so that he could make some of those choices. But once he was hooked up, he was not able then to unhook himself from those life-sustaining devices. I just then want to share with you just for a moment or two what we went through as the family separate from that. One, the right of an individual to control over his medical procedures. He and we in San Francisco, in Eugene, and then in our house had to go through time and time again convincing the doctors and the medical profession that he had a right to die and how he could choose to do that. In terms of nutrition and hydration, he chose, in order to expedite his dying, he chose to starve himself. There was at one point where he also attempted not to take liquids, and he did that for about 48 hours. Or let me back up, let me just put this in the context, that when he came to our house, we were told, and we never shared this, and it's the only thing we never shared with our son, we were told by the Exceptional Care Committee of the Department of Human Resources that if he didn't die by November 1st, he would be moved into a nursing home. Now put that in the context of a death with dignity and people having a right to die and how they should choose. So he had to die by November 1st, or he was going to be moved into a nursing home. That was the one and only thing we never shared with him. In the middle of October, then, he made a decision to try and expedite his dying because he was an extremely healthy young man and chose not to take liquid. After 48 hours, he decided that he couldn't do it anymore, and I stood there, and he could only speak with a trach tube, and prevented him from not speaking and said, Eddie, I'm not going to honor your request. Do you really want to do this? And he looked at me, and then I couldn't just not, and he said, Dad, why are you doing this? The issues, you know, I mean, they have been outlined time and time again by what you've heard. I think it is important to look at that issue of dehydration and food and the right of people to have some sense of control over that.
All right, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Ulhorn and members of the committee and the audience, the way the bill is drafted, your son would not be included within the provisions. I just want to make that clear.
I understand that. And if I had, and I wish I had more time, because much of what you've heard is, we've had the experience. And I'm only in part sharing the types of conversations and the problems that we are faced with every day in terms of trying to help ourselves and our son and whomever and the decisions that we're faced with.
Appreciate you being here and sharing your experience with us.
Thank you.
Mr. Simons?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lauren Simons, and I live at 2936 Willamette, apartment number 3 in Eugene. I support the committee's intent to provide a legal basis by which an individual can declare and determine under what circumstances their life is to be preserved. I support this goal, but I am sorry to say that I do not find these bills are to be adequate in protecting the rights of individuals who, because of injury or illness, require extensive medical care. Before I address my specific concerns within the bills, let me explain why I am concerned about the long-term and judgmental consequences of these bills as they are written. I was born in 1955, 2 1/2 months premature. I was presumed at that time by medical providers that I would not live, and that if I did live, I would not be educatable. They assumed that I would not have a high quality of life. The actual prognosis at that time was identical to the Baby Jane Doe case, where the parents wished to have medical care withheld. Their rights were later upheld. Who is to say that anyone has the ability to know what a person's future holds? No one ever anticipated that I would graduate in the top 20% of my high school class and would later graduate with a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Oregon. My specific concerns about Senate Bills 20 and 21 as they are written are as follows. The physician's role is broken down into 5 different aspects. Point A, as referred to in Section 5, Subsection 1, Senate Bill 20 would allow for physicians to determine the appropriate manner, time, and place of withholding care. I do not believe, as research continues to develop new ways to respond to medical conditions, that any medical care should be withheld unless previously directed by the patient or the person whom they grant power of attorney. I do not believe the physician should have any role in the actual determination of withholding care in Section 7 of Senate Bill 20. Under Section 9 of Senate Bill 20, the good faith clause is not adequate as a standard of care in conjunction with substantial compliance of this act. Section 9 and 10 of Senate Bill 20 appear to provide blanket immunity for physicians because the guidelines of Section 5 are subjective and appear to circumvent directives which would specify exact time, manner, and extent of withholding life-sustaining procedures. Point E is, who can seriously determine actual incapacitation talked about in Section 6 of Senate Bill 20. I would want to verbally interject at this point that I know of a case where a person was head injured and an EEG was administered to determine whether brain waves were present. At that time, brain waves were not present in any way, shape, or form, but within 2 weeks, by sustaining their life through the medical care, brain waves returned. And that person is now under treatment to become fully independent and lives in their own home. Second section is the inclusion of nutrition and hydration. Instead of reading that exactly, I'll just indicate that there are cases where people, because of the level of their spinal cord injury, have no choice but to be fed through these tubes as a normal means of being fed, not as an extraordinary means of being fed as in the case of administering other medical care. And therefore, flexibility as to how that's going to be provided needs to be dealt with. In view of my short time, I also want to add that I oppose the criteria to omit imminent death and terminal illness as part of the criteria. Fifth, there have been national studies done which indicate that in organ transplants, the issue of a person's ability to pay actually is already entered into as many as 25% of the cases in some states, rather than the next person on the waiting list having access to that organ. Also, contrary to to other people's opinions. I feel that a child's right to medical care should be independent of the parents.
Thank you very much. All right, sir, let's see. Next we have Catherine Parvin. All right, Catherine Parvin, and then Elizabeth Davis will be next, and then Steve Miller. Are those...
Catherine Parvin, 3690 Lakeview Boulevard, Lake Oswego, Oregon. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you concerning Senate Bills 20 and 21. I am an attorney, and I have also done extensive volunteer work with the handicapped. I'm opposed to Senate Bills 20 and 21 and deeply concerned about abuses that could occur if this legislation were enacted. I would initially like to relate to you two incidents. The first incident involved a 19-year-old Medford boy whose mother testified before the task force. This young man was in a coma and diagnosed as having no possibility of recovery. He was removed from a respirator without the parents' permission. In this case, the parents stepped in to secure continuance of life support. The young man regained consciousness, is now married, and a father. The incident points out that even professional medical judgment can err concerning chances of patient recovery. Senate Bill 20, by permitting the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures in much broader circumstances than current legislation, permits the effects of such errors to be much more serious. As you know, the proposed legislation removes the criteria of terminal illness and imminent death as limitations on situations in which life-sustaining procedures may be withdrawn. Additionally, mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration may be withdrawn. Consider also the situation where the patient has no family, which was fortunately not the case with the Medford young man, and where the attending physician knows of no adult friends. Under Section 6 of Senate Bill 20, the physician can make the decision to withdraw life-sustaining procedures even if the patient has not signed a directive, with very little legislative restriction applying. Patient choice may definitely not be furthered in this situation. The second incident I would like to relate involves a 44-year-old Maryland woman named Jacqueline Cole. She suffered a stroke and then lapsed into a coma. Although she was not brain dead, her physician described her condition as a persistent vegetative state. Her husband, a Presbyterian minister, went to the court seeking removal of life support. The judge denied the request, and 6 days later, after being in a coma for 47 days, Mrs. Cole regained consciousness. Although she's currently still affected by the stroke, both Mrs. Cole and her husband are grateful that she's alive. In analyzing the possibility for error or abuse under the proposed legislation, consider that Senate Bill 20 would permit the withdrawal of mechanical provision of food and water from a middle-aged patient with a condition where death was not imminent, but who had executed a directive many years earlier without contemplating his current medical condition. The proposed legislation does require that a person be in the active and natural process of dying. However, this is a phrase that's extremely unclear and has not been legally defined. For issues as important as what we're considering today, we need precise legal definitions. I'd like to skip to page 4 of my testimony and mention that I'm particularly concerned about Section 6 of Senate Bill 20, and that it does not adequately protect handicapped, elderly, or seriously ill patients from the decisions of others that these patients' lives are not worth living. As has been explained to you, the section applies to individuals that have not executed directives, and it permits the withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures including the artificial provision of food and water, by specified individuals' requests. Death need not be imminent, and terminal illness, that term is not used. The restriction that the patient be in the active and natural process of dying does not, in my opinion, provide an adequate safeguard. Additionally, cutbacks in federal funding and increased demand by patients needing care in medical facilities would add to the pressure placed on the medical profession to make decisions that could detrimentally affect our handicapped and elderly members of society. In conclusion, I'd ask you to recall the stories of the Medford young man and of Jacqueline Cole. Should we not err, if we err at all, on the side of preserving life? I support Mr. Castagna's comments with regard to this
I'm executive director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. We're the state's protection and advocacy agency for persons labeled developmentally disabled and mentally ill. You have a copy of my written testimony. I guess the points that I would like most to make is that in protecting persons who many times find themselves in a devalued situation, either through an institutional placement or abandonment by their natural families, we think that these individuals need special protections, especially when they also have a disability. And I think that in the other areas that we've been involved in protection of persons' rights and in guardianship, sterilization, medical neglect issues, we have looked for precise definition of terms, expertise by decision makers, and an impartial forum for a review of limiting and sometimes permanent decisions, and we think that that is crucial to protecting the individual's privacy, dignity, and to prevent non-medical factors from being considered in the decision-making process. Section 6 and 7 of Senate Bill 20 have many words and phrases that are not precise and do need definition, and I understand that there is going to be some attempt to define some of those terms and would certainly support that those terms be defined. I guess our major concern is what I've raised, and that is that there are oftentimes non-medical considerations that are entered that are considered such as disability in making what is should essentially be a medical decision. And I've cited several examples that we've faced in the last year where, in fact, that has happened on behalf of our clients. And I would ask the committee to consider those in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Lance, the definition of active and natural process of dying, there have been several amendments that have been submitted. Perhaps after the meeting you could talk with Mr. Shoemaker. He'll show you his proposed
I saw it briefly at the recess.
And you can send in any comments that you have on that proposal or any other proposal, because that is going to be something the committee is going to be working on to come up with a definition for that term.
Thank you. I'll do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hamby.
Just a brief comment. I'm appalled at your illustrations in your testimony. That's all.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Remison.
Good evening, Senator Hill and members of the committee. I need to begin by modifying my testimony. It started out by saying good afternoon, and we're way past that. I'm appearing this evening on behalf of the Association for Retarded Citizens of Oregon, Oregon's largest advocacy organization for persons with mental retardation, representing 2,000 members statewide and 23 local member units. I also speak as a member of the Guardianship, Advocacy, and Protective Services Board, which is a program run by the Association of Retarded Citizens, where we serve as legal guardians for approximately 30 people with mental retardation. The concerns that the ARC has are highlighted in my testimony, and they fall primarily within Section 6. Which describes those situations where a person who is not competent to give medical testimony is allowed to have somebody else come in and make those decisions for them. I am particularly aware of some of these situations being a GAPS member or a GAPS board member, and I have highlighted, I think, two examples within my testimony which perhaps, I think, raise two aspects of this bill that it may not have been raised yet this afternoon, and I'd like to go over them just very briefly. The first situation that GAPS was involved in involved a situation that Mr. Lance, I think, alluded to, which involved a situation of the person's condition or life circumstance prior to the hospitalization being taken into account when decisions regarding life-sustaining measures and other medical treatment was an issue. It is not one that is appropriate for consideration, but the reality is that many physicians still do take mental retardation or mental illness into account when making medical decisions, and Section 6, as written, would allow that practice to continue. The other thing that I want to briefly highlight is that Section 6 and Section 7 talk about locating persons in priority order upon reasonable effort. No one has addressed today what reasonable efforts means, but in one situation where GAPS was involved, the guardianship papers were in the file, they were on the top in one of the sections, and yet when decisions had to be made, those papers were not read or recognized as being guardianship papers, and decisions were made without our notification and without our decisions. Certainly, I think we take our responsibility seriously, but obviously somebody else did not and did not give our guardianship status the due consideration that it was should be afforded. The other consideration that I would like to raise that has also not been raised today is that in the priority listing, guardianship comes second after spouse. Generally speaking, or I think in every situation, a guardian has been appointed by the court, has the authority to make those medical decisions, and I don't believe that a spouse in any situation would relieve the guardian of that responsibility. And I believe in all situations that a guardian should have primary responsibility if somebody has gone to court and gotten guardianship for the purpose of making medical decisions. I don't believe even a spouse has the authority to supplant that decision-making ability. Thank you, Mr. Kramer, for your timer, and I will be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Elliott Wooten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Peter Elliott Wooten.
Wooten? Sorry.
Well, it gets misspelled. People mishear it, misspell it, and then naturally yes.
It's
mispronounce
it.
It's
O-O here, so that's
yeah, that's why I said I thought that was what happened. My name is Peter Elliott Wooten, and I live in Eugene. If you want the address, it's 875 East 32nd Avenue in Eugene. I'm employed on a contract basis by Oregon Health Decisions in order to conduct a statewide information project and survey on the subject of living wills and powers of attorney. For brevity, I'm going to skip some of this because it's all in the testimony. Essentially, what I'm doing, I'm giving you the testimony of approximately 400 people who aren't here on some of the major substantive issues in the bills. The total number of respondents so far was 399. Most of these were from the Portland and Salem areas, although the survey process is being extended throughout the state. The age range is 16 to 83 with a mean of 40.2 years. I'm not going to read you the breakdown, but they're not all older people, for example. Breakdown by gender shows approximately 75% female and 25% male. With respect to religion, the breakdown is as follows. Protestant, 42%, Catholic, 16%, Jewish, 3.5%, agnostic, 3.5%, other, 12.3%, and missing, people who didn't put it down, 21.8%. Healthcare workers outnumber non-healthcare workers in the sample 65% to 35%. Some who list themselves as healthcare workers or volunteers. There are a few surprises. With respect to age, those in the 75 to 94 age bracket responded more positively to questions number one, dealing with oral and nonverbal living will or directive, and number three, inclusion of food and water, and somewhat more positively, to number four, the witness restriction. So when one thing jumps out, it's that the older people are more ready to accept those points of oral or nonverbal directive and the inclusion of food and water. There are no significant differences between responses of men and women. The religious differences are generally not significant, except that those who call themselves agnostics show a strong preference for inclusion of food and water in the definition of artificial procedures, and those who checked other show a somewhat stronger preference for the same item. Overall, the impression gained from these responses is that Oregon residents surveyed are in favor of the proposed changes and that differences among the various subgroups are not great. The strongest favorable response is for Senate Bill 21, calling for the establishment of a power of attorney for health care. The attached sheet shows a breakdown of responses by subgroup. For simplicity, strongly agree and agree have been combined, as have disagree and strongly disagree. A copy of the complete printout has been given to the committee for your staff to study in case you want to refer to that. By the time the survey is completed, at least 1,500 surveys will have been completed, and our intention is to have that total spread over the state to the extent possible. If either or both of these bills should be passed before the survey is completed, new questionnaires will be prepared. The information is all here if you have any questions. We have also supplied you with copies of the questionnaire, the material we passed on at the meetings, and so on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Watton. Thank you for your information.
And if I may correct again, the last name is Elliot Watton. It's one of those newfangled hyphenated names.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. Gerald Clark. Okay. Stephen Bolin or Bowlin.
They just stuck a W in. It's not supposed to be in there.
Okay. Bolin. All right.
It's a pleasure to be speaking before this the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Steve Bolin. I am an attorney. I'm in private practice emphasizing estate planning. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Bar and a member of the estate planning section. I personally am unaware of the estate planning's section endorsement of these two bills proposed before the Senate bills right now. I am in opposition to both Senate bills. I have prepared several hundred directives to physicians or living wills for my clients since the original legislation in 1977 and the subsequent amendments in 1979 and 1983. I believe that the legislation that's being proposed now goes far beyond the scope of what was discussed in conference previous to the passage and the amendments of the prior bill. Some of the things that I would like to state as far as Senate Bills 20 and 21, the current law requires that an individual who's 18 years old, as you're aware, execute the written directive to withhold or withdraw the life-sustaining procedures in the event of the incurable condition certified to be terminal by two physicians where the life support procedures only prolong the moment of death, which is in any event imminent and witnessed by two unrelated and disinterested individuals to the declarant. In my written testimony, I've underlined different areas. I think there are about 10 different areas from that clause alone that are being directly affected by the proposed legislation. And to just recap in summary briefly, some of those changes, Senate Bill 20 and 21 lowers that age from 18 to 15 years old. 15 years of age required, as you're aware, even to vote at 18, 21 to drink, but when it comes to a decision as crucial as a life or death situation, there's a proposal of 15 years old, and I believe that the directive or power by a minor, possibly in opposition to that minor's parents' wishes, is just fraught with legal difficulties, which I see will never come to an end for quite a while, if at all. The requirement of the written directive is the next area I've discovered, I've gone over. The next area is on that the bills are overly broad and vague, as has been brought up before, and that the critical terms and phrases was shared before, the active and natural process of dying, also the including mechanical and artificial provisions of nutrition and hydration. Those have been added but not defined, and remain too vague. Some of the other areas is the terminal, the need for two physicians, where now just the attending physician can make the decision, the elimination of the requirement that death is imminent. The witness clause is an important provision that, where under the current law, there are two witnesses that have to be disinterested individuals not taking from a person's estate, and that has been eliminated, and I think that is a vital change to this, and that the bills should be tabled and not passed by the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bowen. Next witness, Robert W. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert W. Smith. I live 951 East 36th Street, Eugene. I am chairman of the State Legislative Committee of the American Association of Retired Persons. And because I understand some other AARP persons have signed up here, I might add that the State Legislative Committee, composed of persons from around the state, is the only group with the authority to speak on legislative matters for the Oregon AARP. The most important, I speak on behalf of the Oregon AARP supporting Senate Bills 20 and 21. The most important right a person possesses is the right of self-determination. The right to refuse medical treatment is part of that larger right. Courts repeatedly have declared that a competent person has a right to refuse life-sustaining treatment. Senate Bills 20 and 21, we think, will assist in protecting that right. To skip some of my brief testimony, the great advantage we see in the proposed legislation is that it ensures persons a fuller measure of autonomy. If a person wishes his life to be prolonged without regard to his chances of recovery or the cost of the procedures, he or she can so indicate in the directive to physicians. Let those of us who think otherwise exercise our preference. All the persons with whom I have talked at AARP chapter meetings desire that they not be resuscitated when they are dying, that they not be subjected during their last days or weeks to diagnostic and therapeutic procedures that are senseless, costless, and undignified. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Jeff Brandon. And after Jeff Brandon will be Carolyn Lobitz.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Brandon. I'm from Portland. I work with Multnomah County, and my position is Deputy Public Guardian and Conservator. I'm here not speaking for Multnomah County, so I'm speaking for myself and for a group that I'm affiliated with, the Protective Services Coalition for Multnomah County. I'm one of two public people in the state of Oregon that act as a public guardian, because Multnomah County has the only program. And so for 9 years, I've been essentially a professional substitute decision maker for incapacitated people. I'm here speaking against Senate Bill 21. My testimony has nothing to do with death with dignity issues. I'm speaking directly about 21 as a method for passing substituted decision making to another person. And my contention is that in tying 21 with 20,
major issues have been passed over, and I want to try to focus your attention on some major issues just with 21, apart from death with dignity issues. Let me just present a simple hypothetical. Say Senator Wires was sitting there, and the issue is, say, I say he's my friend, and I know him, and I want to plan for my future incapacity, and I want to make him my power of attorney for my property. Is that legal? Yes. All I have to do is go to a legal stationery store and get a power of attorney form and fill it out, and Senator Wires could be my power of attorney in my incapacity over my property and finances. Now, continue the hypothetical. What if I want to make him my decision maker for medical issues over me once I'm incapacitated? Can I go to a legal stationery store and fill out a form and do that? No, I can't. 1 minute already. Okay. The question is, should I be able to do that? And my point is, no, I should not be able to do that. There's a very good reason why we don't have a power of attorney for health care in Oregon and in most of the United States, and that is because of a legal historical principle of English American law, and that is this, that I cannot pass to another the right to make medical decisions over my body without due process of law. That's the key point I want to emphasize to you. Power of attorney of health care does not have due process of law. And if you look at my paper, you'll see the radical nature of this Senate Bill 21 in the continuum of health care decision making in this state. I've provided a graph that shows how radical it is to put this above guardianship in the spectrum of authoritative decision making. My other two big reasons are, number two, abuse. There is already tremendous abuse of power of attorney over property, and this will now give us a tool whereby the abuser exploiter can use power of attorney health care to continue the abusive pattern. My third thing is complications. This law would cause so many complications with existing system that it boggles my mind. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brandon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Brandon, is there any statutes or case law that you know of in Oregon that prohibit currently a person with the assistance of counsel or without preparing a power of attorney for health care? My question is not that practice currently being done without a statute on the books either permitting it or prohibiting it?
Apparently it is. I've heard that it is. I've rarely ever run into it, but I've heard of people doing that. As far as I know, the community considers that to be illegal.
All right, but, okay, thank you.
Ms. Lobitz? And after Ms. Lobitz will be...
Priscilla Martin. And Shirley Bernard.
Priscilla Martin and Priscilla Martin. Ms. Lobitz.
I'm Caroline R. Lobitz. I'm speaking as a private citizen, but one who is very concerned and involved in these matters. I attended all but one of the Death with Dignity Task Force hearings. In this pluralistic society, I believe individuals should have options. One of the very important of these is the time and manner of one's dying when there is no reasonable hope for recovery. I do not believe that any particular manner should be enforced upon anyone against his or her will, but neither do I feel that others should force their preferences on me. It is for this reason that I support the concept of the legal living will or directive and the power of attorney for health care and the particular provisions being proposed for change in Senate Bills 20 and 21. A very important aspect of these statutes is that they would permit a much wider range of preferences as to the specific provisions allowed those who desire to sign such documents. I especially favor the inclusion of artificial or mechanical nutrition and hydration among the life-sustaining procedures which may be withheld or withdrawn when there is no reasonable expectation of a person's recovery. It must be emphasized that both current and proposed laws do not obligate anyone to sign a directive or create a power of attorney for health care, but only permit one to do this with the expectation that these personal options shall be adhered to. And I'm going to skip to a little later hard, my testimony to be more brief. I have signed a directive to physicians in the presence of a lawyer, a power of attorney for health care, which refers to what you were asking, and have composed a personal living will which defines what I do or do not want done when I am no longer able to make health decisions for myself and there is no reasonable expectation of my recovery. It ends up with the words, I would like to have these wishes carried out to the extent permitted by law. Insofar as they are not legally enforceable, I hope that those to whom this will is addressed, my family, physicians, and lawyer, will regard themselves as morally bound by these provisions. The proposed legislation, Senate Bills 20 and 21, would give legal force to these my strongly held desires, and I sincerely hope these bills will be passed as written.
Thank you. Priscilla Martin.
Good evening, Senator Hill and Chairman and members of the committee. Sorry it's so late, and you've been here so long, and you're tired, and appreciate your suffering through all these long hours of testimony, but as you're well aware, it's a very important issue. I'm from Portland, and I head up a pro-life organization, Lifesavers of America, formed to oppose anti-life forces which are threatening our society. My main point, I don't want to repeat what others have already said, so I'll try not to repeat anything, you know, duplicated. My main point tonight is that I believe most strongly that the people of Oregon do not want this legislation. Since the Death with Dignity Task Force first began its work, I've attended nearly every one of their public hearings, and I agree with Sharon Caldwell that the process has been rather a mockery and a little bit of a charade, as they have brought the same witnesses forth, along with some liberal clergy, to bring out over and over again in an attempt to prove and convince the public that there is existing a real need or a justification for the legislation in the first place. And I say most assuredly there is not any genuine need at all for this legislation. Traditionally, doctors have never been forcing people to stay alive and performing heart transplants on 90-year-old men who are dying of terminal cancer and things like that, as some of the people on the other side would have us believe. They have allowed people to die with dignity while preserving their comfort right up to the moment of death by not starving them, by giving them intravenous glucose solutions and calories and things like that to make their death as comfortable as possible. So there is no real need for it in the first place, and I call it a like an emperor's new clothes situation. It's all illusion, but there's no substance to the fact that there is really no need for it. Now, just getting to the point now, in a few days' time, from a circulation of a petition in opposition to these bills, I'm now presenting to you, members of the Judiciary Committee, petitions bearing the signatures of nearly 1,000 Oregonians that are opposed to these two bills. And every day the petitions continue to come into us, and I believe most emphatically that these represent an outpouring of the feeling of Oregonians who are not deceived by the misleading propaganda of the pro-choice advocates pushing these bills. And summing up, these are thinly disguised euthanasia, assisted suicide, enabling legislation bills, and Oregonians, in my opinion, are simply not going to stand for these bills. So on behalf of myself and all other Oregonians concerned for life, I strongly encourage you to let these bills die a quote-unquote natural death here in the committee, and I thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Excuse
Hamby.
Me. I apologize. May I ask?
Yes. Sorry.
I'm sorry. May I ask, is this the question you asked of the individuals prior to signing the petition?
Yes, and there was also a letter which went into explanation which accompanied, maybe I should have given you the letter. I can give you copies of that letter afterwards, or now, or whatever, because the letter explained what the bill would do, what it would allow for, how it would allow 15-year-old children to make these decisions.
Many of the points that have already been brought out earlier tonight were in the covering accompanying letter, and we told them, you know, how they could make their phone calls or sign the petitions and have their friends and neighbors sign. So I'll be happy to make sure you get room, Senator.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, if you could give that to our committee assistant, we'll copy it for the committee.
Sure, I certainly will. Be happy to.
Reverend William Addix. Marilyn Smith. Marilyn Smith. Brian Hines. Shirley Barnes.
Did you say the last name?
Shirley Barnes. Molly Weinstein.
She can't say.
Alan Deal. Pam Edens.
These are three together.
Yes, Pam Edens, Mary Davenport.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak tonight regarding this very coming sensitive issue. I am Pam Edens, Oregon Alzheimer's Disease Association Advocacy Coordinator Volunteer, and I have a family member with Alzheimer's disease. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Alzheimer's Disease Related Disorders Association Advocacy Committee, which represents thousands of family members of an Alzheimer's disease related disorders victim in Oregon. We are in support of Senate Bills 20 and 21. Alzheimer's disease is the fourth leading cause of death in older adults following heart attack, cancer, and stroke. Currently, there are approximately 50,400 Oregonians with Alzheimer's disease. This disease is terminal, and no cure exists. The final death of an Alzheimer's disease victim is looked at as being the second death of their loved one. The first death comes with the death of the person's mind, their memory, personality, intellect, warmth, etc. The final death of the body is of the body, and that's a time for families to honor their loved one's wishes, whatever they might be. We want the ability of options for families when death is imminent. The family's decision on death for their loved one does not come easily, but with the legal ability of choice comes more options, and therefore the best decision for the loved one is made. The fear that some individuals have that senile people would be put to their death is simply unfounded.